Love Talk Radio.
Everybody, just get ready.
Yes, here it comes, blessed souls, the brightest light ever, the bright light of universal redemption. Blessings and greetings, greetings and blessings. We're alive because we're blessed to stay alive in those existential, eternal moments in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. You now tune into Blog Talk Radio, and we humbly suggest, and we even a little less humbly assert that we are the higher inner frequency of Blog Talk Radio. We're called Soul Class. This happens to be Soul Class 653, Torah Free Fall for all those who heed the call, Part 1. Blessed is our Creator. Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the entire human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live on June 4th, 2017. It's 10:31 a.m. live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will be quite eclectic, discussions ranging from reading the story about one Jewish woman who was educated to the exclusion of knowing what is good, a Torah perspective concerning ecological matters, teachings from Rambam, and whatever else we can cram into our one-hour broadcasting. Our call-in number, if you want to be a live participant and make the class a little bit more organic, the number is 347-838-8669. As well, at the end of the program, we'll be talking about a type of life sense technology that you yourself, blessed souls, can access called the Helo LX, and I happen to be a Helo LX distributor. We'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the program. Meanwhile, may the eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peaceful and pleasantly. You're listening to Here Comes the Time, the extended version by Brother in Soul Prayer and Fellowship, Rev. Isaac Patone from his seminal work, Generation Redemption. I want to tell you, blessed souls, as we turn down the music, that Rabbi Isaac is working on a new cut called You Got to Be Good. I know we talk about that as we segue out of the vast majority of our programs because we've got to be good, and we'll talk a little bit about that hopefully at the end of today's program. But before we proceed further, we're going to introduce our Rambam teacher and student disseminator for the teachings of the Nesher Gadol, the great eagle Rambam, Moshe Ben Maimonides, Rambam, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Shalom, or if we were in the first century, I'd say Shalima, which is an Aramaic expression for shalom.
Well, I'm sure people that are, there are still actually, Dennis, people that speak Aramaic, I believe, out in certain regions of Iran, because I have some friends who came from Persia, known as the modern state of Iran, and they told me that they knew of people that actually still speak the Aramaic. So it's not a dead language. It's actually quite a fertile language. It's lasted over, well over 3,000 years old, and we hope it will continue.
It started somewhere after the Babylonian captivity.
it could have been before. I mean, there are viewpoints that even Aramaic could be going back as far as even before Abraham, who was before the Babylonian captivity. Anyway, Dennis, we're going to start off today's program. First of all, I want to dedicate our humble efforts today to the elevation of the soul of my father, Rav Shlomo Yaakov Olav Shalom, Ben Chunah David Olav Shalom, my grandfather, his father. This should serve as a good source of tidings for wherever he is in the realms, in the upper realms of creation, or as the Lubavitch Rebbe used to call it, the next level of life. So we're going to start off with a seminal teaching from a seminal work by Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, the modern patriarch of the Hasidic movement. Some people have a misunderstanding about the Hasidic movement, thinking it's only something which is about 270 up to 300 years old, which started in the Eastern Europe and Russia and the Ukraine, actually goes way, way back in time to the times even before King David. So that's something for you to do a little research on Blessed Souls. But here's one of the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. One of the missions in the life of Rabbi Yishua Baal Shem Tov was to quiet down the fire of egotism, and even within the Jewish world. And here's a teaching will give you some idea of what he was trying to attempt to do. And the message still calls out to us today, whether we be Jew or one of the Kobe Olam, one of the blessed members of the Children of Noah, which encompasses the entire human family experience, 7 billion plus of us. Born on a summit, a lesson in humility. A man once set off on a journey. While his wagon driver paid attention to the route, he dozed off and was oblivious to his surroundings. The wagon approached a mountain and began to slowly climb the steep gradient. Eventually, it reached the top, where the route was smooth for a while. At that point, the passenger awoke. If anyone would tell him that he was traveling along the summit of a mountain, he would not believe it, because the route, according to him, looked quite flat. He did not experience the torturous climb, nor view the steep winding road that crawled up the mountainside. However, when the plateau ends and the steep winding descent into the valley begins, he will admit that he must have been on a mountaintop after all. Similarly, a person does not realize that he is filled with conceit and inappropriately raises himself above others. He may consider himself to be a great scholar, a product of pedigree, a magnate, a portrait of good and ethical character traits, even a tzaddik, a righteous person, God-fearing, and a pleasant and delightful individual. He considers himself above everyone else, to the point that his belief is dignity to fraternize with them. At the same time, he realizes that if he openly flouts himself as harboring all these wonderful qualities, people would be disgusted at his arrogance. So he adds, quote-unquote, humility, as the Baal Shem Tov, this is translated into English, blessed souls, so humility was put into quotation marks, to his list of superiorities. Now that he is gracious enough to fraternize with others, he considers himself humble as well. However, he does not realize that he is stuck in the height of arrogance because he never saw himself scaling its heights. That is because he was born on a summit. For people are born, all people are born with a natural dose of arrogance. Since he begins life atop a mountain, he is entirely incapable of seeing his true position. He will only realize the truth when he descends on the other side, when he works on lowering himself and being truly humble before others and engages in the humbling service of recognizing the supreme greatness of his Creator and corresponding lowliness of man, which includes himself. And then he will recognize his mountain for what it is. To rid himself of the mountain, he must descend all the way to the valley by acting with genuine humility, and more critically, by developing a genuinely humble heart. Dennis, one person, I don't recall learning about him being arrogant, but certainly this was the path of Rambam, who knew how to descend into the valley, not for the sake of necessarily humbling himself, because I never read about him being arrogant, but more as to elevate others to help them climb up the mountain of their own personal life experience of how to actualize all their potentialities. Your take on this teaching?
Well, the Rambam wasn't arrogant because he was trying to help and transfer knowledge to other people so that understanding could take place. So he put himself on the same level as everybody else, even though he knew a lot more. So if you want to dial down your ego, start feeding your humility. Your humility will lower your ego because, after all, how important do you think you are? If you are thinking that you are greater than a grain of sand on the beach, you're confusing yourself with nature. And that is, we are on the same equal basis, and we must keep reminding ourselves, or else our ego will get out of alignment. Very easy to think that you're better than everybody else, but we must be humbled before God, or else we're looking for something that we don't want, and you'll be the successor of something that you put yourself into, like shooting yourself in the foot for no reason, when you're no greater than every other human being.
True, Dennis, I once heard a teaching, actually it was on a tape recording when I was a student in Israel in Yeshiva, that Rabbi Avraham Lipskitz, maybe Gesund Stark, strong and healthy, once said that if we don't work on taking out the oppressor, at that time, there was a big problem with Saddam Hussein, not the second Gulf War, but the first Gulf War, when he actually began throwing launching Scud missiles into the airspace and landing in Israel, caused about $10 billion worth of damage to the country. And Rabbi Lipska said that if we don't take care of the Saddam Hussein, the terrorists, the cruelty, the streak of cruelty within ourselves, that we can, in fact, see that the Creator works the creation, that someone shall come along to do things that are not to our liking. Now, he wasn't trying to give us students a guilt complex, but just giving as an illustration. Sometimes, you know, there are teachings from Midrash and the oral dimensions of Torah, oral Torah traditions, which are very, very allegorical, but a person's supposed to look beyond the allegory to see what the allegory is hinting to. So if we're not going to humble ourselves, there will come some other part of creation in the form of a human or non-human, or maybe a piece of glass that, God forbid, a person could cut their toe on, or a bumblebee to give them a bite, you know, that will humble us. So that's just, I just want to react to what you just said, Dennis. Any other take on that before we move on to a letter from the Rebbe?
Yeah, just one other thing, Don, and that is, if you think you're better than other people, your ego is causing a distortion in your brain. And what you're doing there is you're making a judgment about other people. And we must always remember there's only one judge that we report to, and that is the judge of life. And you're always responsible for it, and anything that you made a mistake is going to be brought up, hopefully, at that time of judgment.
True. Thank you, Dennis. Now, we're going to turn to a short letter by the Lubavitch Rebbe. It's titled True Judgment. It was written on the 15th of Iyar, 5738, which corresponds to May 22nd, 1978. And apparently this Jewish man who wrote to the Rebbe had some ill feelings, which he wanted to place the blame on the fact that he interacted with a certain yeshiva and he didn't like the conduct of the students. So the Rebbe responded to his feelings and his Jews, other feelings towards other Jews based on something that he didn't like about this particular yeshiva, which is not named, or the particular students of the yeshiva. Here's the Rebbe response. It's a two-paragraph response. And then there's a universal instruction here. It's not just pertaining to the Jewish people, to all peoples. Needless to say, the connection, basically, was in, I see how you're connecting the dots, but the connection is most surprising. For it's plain and obvious that a Jew, whoever he may be, or that for she be, who believes in the Torah and does his or her best to observe the commandments, the mitzvahs, does it because of his personal commitment to God's Torah and mitzvahs, which were given to each and every Jewish person, man, woman, and child at Mount Sinai. And our sages tell us that the souls of the Jews of our generations were present there and accepted the Torah and the commandments. Hence, if a Jew should declare, God forbid, that he does not accept the Ten Commandments because his friends or teachers do not conduct themselves as they should, I do not think that anyone will say that this is a proper or sensible approach. Concluding, the Rebbe wrote, to put in a different way, if a teacher whom you respect will say that 2 times 2 is 5, obviously that's incorrect. And then if there's another teacher who you do not respect will say 2 times 2 equals 4, well, the teacher you don't respect is actually correct. For truth is independent of who you, truth is independent of regardless of who you respect or don't respect. And judging by your writing, there is surely no need to elaborate to you on what is self-evident. And I think I brought that point out, is that whether we respect or not respect another person based on their conduct, the point is, are they leading us or assisting us some way towards truth? So if they have a personality flaw, if they have something lacking in their overall persona, is that going to become an impediment in terms of our relationship with him or her, or should we look at the greater picture that they do have some capacity to share truth with us? Let's embrace that, and then slowly, surely, like in all types of cause and affect relationships when it comes to human beings, which can be so brittle at times and other times as strong as iron, that things will work out if we look at the bigger picture with any human being, which starts with, of course, looking at ourselves, seeing the bigger picture. We have our faults and we have our good points. We shouldn't forget our faults and we shouldn't forget our good points. And we shouldn't judge others because they have different faults and different good points that also we would like to emulate. And before I turn to Dennis, I just want to mention that I plucked these two teachings from the Baal Shem Tov and the Rebbe from a wonderful weekly periodical called Chayenu, which is dedicated to sharing daily Torah study. It's basically about $2, which is shipped around the world. And I'm just turning the pages to let you know, blessed souls, that you can access this. You can go to any Judaica store, basically in the Brooklyn area. This week's edition has 188 pages. I mean, if all of us had the time to read 180 pages a week, times 52, we'd be learning 9,000 pages of Torah a year. We'd certainly become quite scholarly. But you can learn more about getting Chayenu. Let me just get the website here if you want to learn more about it. Let's see, where is the website? Well, they have an email. I haven't found the website yet. I'm sorry about that. And it is the email is info@chayenu.org. And you can, if you have questions or comments or want to find out where you can get this online or order it, there you go. I just gave you the information, the email to this weekly periodical. Dennis, your take on these matters. The Rebbe talking about true judgment, meaning in truth. I mean, you talked about it before, but any amplification would be appreciated on your part.
Well, we are imperfect, but we can love God. That is not an incongruity. It happens at the same time. So therefore, don't be surprised where it seems like these parallel ideas are crossing lines and interfering with each other. Because if your faith and belief is strong enough, you should be able to find the truth. Why? Because your faith and belief will help the light shine on you that comes from above. Our Creator Hashem will make sure that you will see the truth. You may not see the whole truth, but if you love Him, that is truth in and of itself. So trust in our Creator and you will be okay. But if you think you can take human concepts and compare them one to the other, and that's where the truth will come from, be careful. Because again, we're all imperfect.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I thank you, Dennis, for the comment. I actually found the website to Chayenu, and it's very simple. It's Chayenu. Let me read that again. Chayenu.org. And here's a recommendation to become a subscriber of Chayenu. Here's from actually a former NFL lineman with the Green Bay Packers and Dallas Cowboy Super Bowl 17 championship team. His name is Alan Shlomo Weingard, and he writes, as a subscriber of Chayenu, I'm thrilled to finally having a weekly study guide. On the road, traveling often and constantly on the go, Chayenu has provided me an easy way to learn. Written in English, that is perfect for the beginner to the more advanced. I strongly recommend Chayenu to anyone looking for one's booklet to assist you with your personal growth in Torah study. And that's from my former NFL Super Bowl champion. I found that very interesting. With that being said, we're going to turn to one more article, or I'm going to be plucking from an article that is put out by another weekly periodical called L'Chaim. It's spelled L'Chaim, which you can learn more about by going to, here we go, L'Chaim, L-C-H-A-I-M, weekly.org. And there you can learn more about what the Rebbe wrote in letters a contraction of one of the Rebbe's teachings that is produced by actually a very righteous soul by the name of Rabbi Yitzi Horowitz, who is unfortunately struggling and battling with ALS, who was an emissary of the Rebbe in Temecula, California. And actually, the way he writes his blogs is that they're using modern technology, another form of life sense technology, where he actually types the words, the thoughts, from what he's learned before, because he doesn't have the power to open up a safe or a book of Torah anymore. From what he remembers, his mind is still intact, and he actually types out using sensors that are attached to his eyelids, and he can type out his thoughts without the ability to speak, or move even his arms, or make corrections. Everything has to be done with his eyelids. So he has a Torah there. And also there are stories about tzaddikim. It's called, the section is called It Happened Once. But the story I want to talk about, which is one of the primary presentations I want to, you know, share with you today, and Dennis, of course. And by the way, Dennis, I think we mentioned last night before you agreeing to come on the program, since January of 2017, we have increased our listenership in live and archive versions from 18 countries in January of 2017, that as of this week we've upgraded to 39 countries, which has primarily been, we've been helped a lot by having Yaffa Batya da Costa, who you've interacted with live on the air. And as well, just I think because we're becoming a little more eclectic, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing the program in this form now. This is, Blessed Souls, if you followed us for the last 6 years, we had another series called In Search of Authentic, Ancient Authentic Torah. This is sort of a morphing of that into this format, Torah Free Fall for those who heed the call, because we were having separations in time and presentation, and we were going very slowly and methodically, which I think was to our credit, in reviewing verses in Scripture. However, I felt it was something that we could make a little bit more contemporary and still at the same time integrate teachings which go way back in time, which hopefully Dennis, as soon as after I make my presentation about this young woman, will be sharing a teaching from Rambam, and also be looking at some teachings from Moses from the chapter 90 of Psalms, and also talking about the ecological situation in the world from a Torah perspective. So let's go a little further. And this is a story. Now, this woman had her name printed in this article, but I'm not going to mention her name. But she talked about growing up, and I'm paraphrasing here at this point. Growing up, she had a very good life. She has one brother who's three younger than her, and her father was a lawyer, and her mother was also a lawyer. So, you know, Jewish family, the father's a lawyer, the mother's a lawyer. What could be better? But the mother started to practice. There was probably a lot of draying around in that house. And the mother left her law practice to become a stay-at-home mom. Hey, you know, my mother did that as well. She was a teacher, professional teacher. When I came along, she stopped, and then she raised myself and my brother for the next 15 years, and then she went back to work. This is what goes on in Jewish homes, observant and non-observant. However, she mentioned when we were, this young woman is saying, when it came to Judaic observance, we were Jewish friendly. We, as many Jews do, they go to synagogue on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. We went to a Passover celebration. We lit the menorah, Hanukkah, and we once in a while even got a little daring and bought some challah. You know, it's luscious bread, just part of the Shabbos and Jewish holiday meals, and we love being Jewish, but we never really did anything of our own accord. Rather, we were traditional Jews. And then this young woman mentioned, then at 12 years old, things got a little sticky for her. Her mother got sick, her parents got divorced, and her younger brother started getting involved with what she calls the quote-unquote wrong crowd. And at that point as well, while she was getting ready for her bat mitzvah, which is the equivalent of a bar mitzvah, meaning in the Jewish tradition that a young woman at the age of 12 reaches a level which is called adulthood. It's not full adulthood, but it's the beginning of adulthood, as a young Jewish man reaches the beginnings of his adulthood at the age of 13. So the classes she was taking for her bat mitzvah, she stopped, and that was the end of her Judaic observance up until that point because of the tremendous disturbances that were taking place in her once upon a time lovely home in Orange County, California, from Newport Beach. I mean, you can just imagine how nice the weather is out there. So fast forwarding, she went to L.A. to go to college. And one day she was walking to campus and saw a shliach Lubavitcher emissary by the name of Rabbi Eli Moshe Levitansky, who was standing in a sukkah, which is the tabernacle or booth that is set up for 8 days during the late summer, early fall year to commemorate the Torah-mandated holiday of Sukkot or Sukkos. So I approached him, we had a conversation, and to fast forward a little bit, I'm just kept paraphrasing, she became very involved in the activities of Chabad, and she became known as that Chabad on-campus girl, meaning she was associated and actually became the president of the Chabad Club over there for Jewish Student Services. She eventually graduated from Cal State University, Northridge, with a degree in political science, international relations, and Middle Eastern studies. A week later, she was going to Washington, D.C., and was going to work the summer at the Jewish Policy Center, which is a nonprofit think tank that works with Jews in America, American-Israeli relations, Middle Eastern politics, and the like. So there she had, in her mind, a dream job working with Jews from different countries, living three blocks from the Capitol building, and there was no shortage of kosher food, and she went to the Chabad house in that area, just as she did on campus. Hey, she was living the life. At the end of the summer, the job, the internship came to an end. Actually, it was a job. It wasn't an internship, excuse me. With that being said, she had to make a decision. Should she stay in the capital city of the United States of America, perhaps to continue to work for that organization or find another job with another Jewish organization, get married? And she said, I was looking at my dream staring at my face. I looked at everything I had spent years and years working towards. I looked at everything and I ever wanted looking me right in the eyes, meaning I had that point where I probably would find a husband in a year or two and find a nice house and, you know, live a nice Jewish quaint life. But one night she lay down and she looked at her dream, staring her right in the face. And she said, I looked at everything I'd spent years and years working towards. I looked at everything that I ever wanted, looking me right in the eyes, and I asked myself, is this really me? And the answer was no. So instead of going on to forward her career and forward her social life and forward her eventual family life, she enrolled in a place called Machon LeYehudut, a center for Jewish studies, and moved to Crown Heights to go to female seminary. Why? Because I felt I needed to learn more on how to not just appear to be as a Jew, but to act properly in accordance to the Torah teachings. But this is the point that I wanted to share with you, blessed souls, that I thought was so poignant to me, was the essence of this article. But it wasn't until coming here that I realized, meaning to the seminary, Machon, it's called Machon LeYehudut, that I realized as I was growing up, and she reviewed that she went to elementary school, middle school, high school, and 6 years in college, she was in school for 19 years. And during those 19 years, not once did I learn how to be a good person. Not once did I learn how to treat somebody else, how to overcome life's challenges or deal with the issues that I myself have inside of me. And I discovered that the Torah and the Hasidic teachings exactly are designed to help a person learn how to be a good person, how to treat someone else with respect, how to overcome life's challenges, and last but not least, we all have issues, regardless of even things are going peachy cream, peachy dandy, or even if things are a struggle, we still, whether things are good or things could be better, there are always matters we really have to try to work out within ourselves. And she says, technically, I could have learned all of that on my own. I mean, I could have had a great life. I could have had my dream home in D.C., a nice big Torah observant family, a nice big house. I could have learned at the local Chabad house. And by osmosis, you know, cognitively speaking, I could have lived a nice, beautiful, and comfortable life. And this is what people dream about. But something inside of me knew that this wasn't enough that would have satiated my dreams of being a fully actualized Jewish woman. Life is about growing, because if we're not growing, then what are we doing with our lives? And that's why I'm here, learning in this Machon LeYehudut. I'm here to grow, I'm here to be uncomfortable, and I love it. Meaning, she's able to identify, she was able at a young age, she's probably 23, 24 years old, to identify the fact that anxiety is not necessarily an end on its own, but there are actually more primordial, or you might say even sublime godly message being sent to person, that there are matters that are in need of correction within our personal sense of selves. I've experienced it. I'm sure Dennis has experienced it. Anyone who's been through enough years, seen enough new moons, seen enough new years, whether it be the Jewish New Year, or the English calendar, or the solar calendar, realize there is a need to realize we need to change and not just say static. If we say this is all I am as just a product of education, secular, even, and I'm going to go on a limb here, even if it has sufficed for me my 15, 20, 31 years, I speak personally now, if I would say to myself, my 31 years of Torah learning has sufficed me to know what I have to know, I don't have to learn anymore, then I personally, Donzos Yagubin, will assert I'm in the process of starting to spiritually, cognitively, and emotionally stagnate. And since we call Torah, Torah's Chaim, an instructions of life, life in itself as an expression of what we should try to emulate is about the process of experiencing continual growth from the day we're born until we go to the next level of life after our proverbial 120 years. I'm sure Dennis has what to say about what I just shared with our listening audience.
Well, as I was listening, Don, I was thinking of myself and other people who have gone through this transition, so to speak. And that is, there was a poem written by an English poet, by I think his name is Robert Still, and the name of the poem was The Hound of Heaven. And what I was thinking about as you were talking is that as we grow up, we learn things, we absorb things, we even bump into things accidentally, but it's all part of us. But the real question is, do you want to know who the you is in you? You must create that motivation of saying there's an inner you, an inner me, and we have to find out what that is, because that's what we are. We have an external shell, but a lot of people don't want to find out what's inside the shell. They're happy with the shell because they're afraid of looking into things. Don't be afraid. It's part of you, and it's what you are. And believe it or not, if you find out what the inner you is, you'll probably like it.
Because I think why we should like it is we realize this is the unique selfness, not narcissistically speaking or being self-engaging. This is the unique you that Hashem, our creator, our almighty loving God, has given you and myself and anyone else who is a human being. We're, so to speak, a present to the world to reveal our potentialities. And with that being said, that's what makes us unique. Because if we weren't unique, why would the Creator put us in the world? To play with our heads? I mean, that's an ideology which I don't buy into. Then, as someone who certainly was engaged in knowledge of self, and it was for the benefit of the entire human family experience, was Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides Rambam. What are you going to share with us today, sir, concerning the Nesher Gadol, the great eagle's sagacity?
Well, believe it or not, you created a nice segue for me, Don, because we're rolling right into a continuation of what we're talking about.
Beautiful.
That is from the Guide for the Perplexed that Maimonides wrote, the Rambam, and we're at page 449 of the online version. So let me continue with the words of, I was about to say the master, but we'll call him Maimonides, the Rambam, a unique person in history for many, many different reasons, and we don't have enough time in this program to go over them all. So let me just read his words. When God desires to produce the best work, no obstacle or hindrance intervenes between him and that work. This is the opinion held by all religious people, also by the philosophers, and it is also our opinion. For although we believe that God created the universe from nothing, most of our wise and learned men believe that the creation was not the exclusive result of his will, but his wisdom, which we are unable to comprehend, made the actual existence of the universe necessary. The same unchangeable wisdom found it as necessary that our existence should precede the existence of the universe. Our sages repeatedly expressed the idea in the explanation of the words, quote, "He hath made everything beautiful in his time," unquote. Ecclesiastes 3:11. Only in order to avoid that which is objectable, for example, the opinion that God does things without any purpose whatsoever. This is the belief of most of our theologians, and in a similar manner have the prophets expressed the idea that all parts of natural products are well arranged, in good order, connected with each other, and stand each other in the relation of cause and effect. Nothing of them is purposeless, trivial, or in vain. They are all the result of great wisdom. For example, quote, "O Lord, how manifold are thy works, and wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of riches," unquote. That's Psalms 104:24, and quote again, "And all his works are done in truth. The Lord by wisdom had founded the earth." That is Proverbs 3:19. This idea occurs frequently. There is no necessity to believe. Otherwise, philosophers' speculation leads to the same result. For example, that the whole of nature, there is nothing purposeless, trivial or unnecessarily, especially the nature of the spheres, which are in the best condition and order in accordance with their superior substance. Now, I'm going to skip another paragraph and a half, because the Rambam was very persistent. And when he has an idea, he just kept hammering away till you got the meaning of it. So let me continue that. And this, what were you going to say, Don?
No, I'm just, I'm listening.
Okay. So the, hang on, where were we?
Okay.
Okay. All right, the other one. Set forth in Scripture on the question and which is proper to accept. It is this. It is not unreasonable to assume that the works of God, their existence and preceding non-existence, are the result of his wisdom. But we are unable to understand many of the ways of his wisdom in his works. On this principle, the whole law of Moses is based. It begins with this principle, quote, "And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was good," unquote. Genesis 1:31. And it ends with the principle, quote, "The rock," capital R, perfect is his work," unquote. Deuteronomy 32:4. So let me just add my own opinion to what I just read, and that is, there's a general rule of thumb that exists, and that is, we must honor everything that God has created.
Mm-hmm. I 1,000% I agree. In fact, I saw a teaching last night. Hopefully, I'm going to post up on Facebook in the coming week when it becomes available for the public. Teaching by the Lubavitcher Rebbe that not even a grain of sand should be considered to be an extraneous part of this creation. Every blade of grass was created for a goat to chew upon to get nourishment. That is all with the divine watching over the we call hashkacha, the maintenance, the management of creation. So I want to thank you, Dennis, for bringing that out. I want to quickly go into just reading the first verse from chapter 90, verse 1, because we do want to talk about ecological matters according to a Torah's perspective. Quickly noting that I want to share with you, blessed souls, that I'm pulling some inspiration from what is known as the Art Scroll Tanakh series from the Book of Psalms. This is chapter 90, a prayer by Moses, the man of God, my Lord, a dwelling place have you been for us in all generations. So what is significant about this whole idea that Moshe is called a man of God? An Israelite sage by the name of Ibn Ezra explains that Moses was the only prophet, he's considered to be the master of all the prophets among within the Israelite nation, 12 tribes of Israel, who saw every divine vision with complete clarity, free from any distortion. Moses also merited to communicate these visions with perfect purity and clarity. Consequently, every word he uttered was considered as emanating from Creator himself. Now, this whole idea of him being called a man of God, Ish Elokim, as we say, or Elokim in the Hebrew, that in the Sifrei, which it commenting on the last portion of the book of Deuteronomy in the oral Torah tradition, there's 10 men who elevated themselves beyond the limits of their physical nature and sanctified their bodies to the extent as they merited the title Ish Elokim, man of God, which I'm going to give you the name of these 10 men and the sources where you can do your own research. And again, I want to remind everyone, we're not here to spoon feed as much as to inspire others who are listening to the live version of today's broadcast or the archive version to go ahead and do your own research. Just don't rely on us. See for yourselves what is being spoken about to learn more about these topics and go deeper into it. So first and foremost, we have Moses, who is mentioned in Psalms 90, verse 1, as a man of God. You can also see him described as a man of God in the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the five books of Moses, chapter 33, verse 1. Elkanah, who is the father of Samuel, and you can learn about that in Samuel, book 1, chapter 2, verse 27. Samuel himself, Samuel the prophet, in the book of Samuel 1, chapter 9, verse 10, King David, who's mentioned in Chronicles 2, chapter 8, verse 14, Shemaiah, who's mentioned in Kings 1, chapter 12, verse 22, Edo is mentioned also in Kings 1, chapter 13, verse 1, Elijah the prophet, many people know about him, Kings 2, chapter 1, verse 13, Elisha the prophet, who was the top disciple of Elijah the prophet, Kings 2, chapter 4, verse 9, Micah or Micah in Kings 1, chapter 20, verse 28. And last, Amos in Chronicles 2, chapter 25, verse 7. And commenting on where Moses wrote down for us, my Lord, a dwelling place have you been for us in all generations. Rashi and Radak, two great scholars in the oral Torah tradition. And this is, we have to really meditated upon this, blessed souls, what Moses was intending when he wrote, my Lord, a dwelling place have you been for us in all generations. You have provided us with a place and refuge in every situation of danger and distress. And unfortunately, we lament over the fact that there's a lot of danger and distress in this modern world, much more than there should be, in light of the fact that because of human beings are becoming more interrelated, not just through marriage, but also cognitively speaking and emotionally speaking, through these wonderful opportunities via, for instance, us doing these humble presentations here on Blog Talk Radio or Facebook, whatever, YouTube, whatever it may be. People are becoming more interconnected, and therefore we need to share this message with other people, Dennis. I feel it's very important to realize Creator is our refuge, in, even in times of distress and danger. And also we make a parenthetical pray out to those who lost their loved ones out in London yesterday with those, I know President Trump called them losers, I call them evil human beings. I want to cut through the fat and the political correctness. Those were evil human beings who, in fact, acted out in terror, in evil acts of terror. Your take on these matters, Dennis.
Well, first of all, I'd like to reflect on Moses again, because you were using the word perfect once or twice in describing his attributes, I guess. But to me, Moses is a representative of the human race and the only individual that was close to God. most of us don't get that close. He was unique in that sense. And so anything he wrote or said should be of great interest to us, because he was very, very close. So we do have some words of God, but we also have the word of Moses. And that's probably easier to swallow because it comes from another human being. And that makes it part of us. We cannot separate ourselves. So even though Moses is a human, he was the closest to our Maker. So therefore, if you want to get, let's call it secondhand information, I don't care what you want to call it, it is very important, because you won't hear better ideas, better concepts laid out and presented. And Maimonides is a representative of that. He, in turn, is like a lower-level character, but he's doing the same fine work that Moses started with. And let's get back to these atrocities that are happening to innocent people all over. Atrocities have been happening all the time all over the world. It's only lately that the newspapers, TV, and other things are actually bringing it out and showing it to people. So it's about time we broke the shell and said, what humans do is not always good, and we cannot look the other way. We must take a stand and say, either you're with the God and the good people, or you're not. There's no in-between. You can't say, oh, well, that's okay, it only happened on a Wednesday. But yet we are blasé enough to say that we can rationalize this stuff. We can no longer do it. There are too many individuals just standing around waiting to have evil beset on them. It must stop.
Thank you, Dennis. Now we're going to turn to... Now, last week there was a lot of controversial reactions. You can call them positive, negative, indifferent, whatever. That President Trump said the United States was pulling out of the Paris Month gathering. I don't want to comment on his decision as much as it opens the door for us to begin a discussion. And we're not going to have the complete discussion. Hopefully next week's program will get a little more into it. The whole idea of the responsibility of human beings as hopefully stewards and becoming better stewards of the earth, because we need to keep this earth sustainable all over the planet. Not that one part of the planet should be sustainable to the disadvantage of another part of the globe, because it's the earth, as the Alter Rebbe, the first Chabad Rebbe, wrote, that the earth is like a mustard seed, and if there's dysfunctionality in terms of not taking care of the planet in any which way, shape, or form, the other part of the planet eventually shall feel the effects. So this whole idea of preventing needless destruction is under the Torah commandment called Bal Tashchit, do not destroy, which in its original context you can learn more about by going to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 20, and actually encompasses two verses, Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 19 and 20. Now, any form, and I'm pulling from a wonderful book called Torah of the Earth, Exploring 4,000 Years of Ecology and Jewish Thought, edited by Arthur Waskow. In particular, this is an article that was written, I'm plucking from an article written by Rabbi Norman Lamb, who is the president of Yeshiva University and author of Faith and Doubt. He was also the founding editor of Tradition, a journal of Orthodox Jewish thought. He mentions that any form of despoilation is forbidden by biblical law, even diverting the irrigation without which the tree will wither and die. Again, it was assumed that Torah was enunciating a general principle in the form of a specific and extreme case. In order to understand the relevancy of Jewish law in the oral Torah tradition on Bal Tashchit, not to destroy, to the problem of ecology, it is important to test certain underlying assumptions of the halachic conception, the Jewish law conception. First, then, it should be pointed out that there is present no indication of any fetish attitude The halacha does not consider any worship of natural objects foreign of themselves. And this is obvious from the passages cited, which, again, I'll leave it to you, Blessed Souls, to go to chapter 20, verses 19 and 20, where other objects, such including artifacts, are covered in the prohibition. Meaning, we're not just talking about destroying fruit trees, as was mentioned in the verses, and again, you can learn more about it, that what must be determined is whether the halacha here is concerned only with commercial values, perhaps based upon the economy of scarcity, and possibly even more exclusively on property rights, or whether there are other considerations beyond the pecuniary, that they, although they are formulated in characteristic halakhic fashion and without reference to any external values, nevertheless may point indirectly to ecological concerns. It is at once obvious that commercial values do play a central role in the law. Thus, there is consideration that a type of fruit tree that can be destroyed if the value of the crop is less than its value as lumber, or if the place of the tree is needed to build a house wherein. But such permission is not granted according to later authorities for reason of aesthetics or convenience, such as landscaping. However, the economic interest is not overriding. It must yield to considerations of health, so that in case of illness and when no other means are available to obtain heat, fruit trees may be cut down and used for firewood. And even when the criterion is a commercial one, it is clear that the waste of an object of economic value per se that the halacha considers unlawful is not concerned with property rights, nor does it seek in these cases to protect private property. However, at the same time, too, there is a problem of undermining the integrity of, say, like a water source. There is also concern that is, and it manifests as it is forbidden to kill an animal needlessly. I know there are certain parts of the world there's a custom which Hino Lubavitch Rebbe spoke very sharply about, that to kill an animal just to hang its head on the wall for display is quote unquote not a human act. And again, it is forbidden to offer exposed water presumed to be polluted or poisoned to livestock. And how much more so, we cannot offer exposed water to pollutants which are going to poison human beings. So there's a lot going on here, but so I'm just bringing it out that we must be aware of that while things are allowed to be chopped down, and sometimes, again, to provide a fire for the wood, to grow something which is even greater worth, it's not a free-for-all in terms of reducing the natural beauty of creation. Now, as well, I just want to mention one more thing, that it is an outright act of vandalism, of diverting a stream from a tree, where, let me just read as it reads here, this law is addressed to all Israel, and hence it is negative in nature, it is prohibited to divert a stream from a tree, but not making an incumbent one actively to sustain every tree. So we see here that on the one hand we can't cause a tree to die by diverting a stream from it, but not every tree has the right to be. At the same time too, you know, this really runs into the core issues of the future energy policy as well, of what are known as developed nations, and nations going to be developed even more. And at the same time, too, there is this clash between the need and the obligation of human beings to consider how can we, in fact, make this world more sustainable while keeping the wheels of production going, because we don't expect, I personally don't expect there to be any reduction in the human population. Heaven forbid, we don't want to ever promote the idea of eugenics, because that was one of the catalysts for eventually what we would be known to be not just as the Holocaust for the Jews, where 6 million perished, but also 6 million Gentiles perished, and 50 million people died in World War II, and 20 million people perished in Russia. Because of the stroke of the pen, Joseph Stalin just decided who would live and who would die, as if he was the creator himself. I got a little eclectic. I mentioned at the beginning of the program, blessings, we would get eclectic, but I'm going to turn over to Dennis because I know his shoulders are wide enough to balance all these ideas and to throw his own commentary on the matter.
What we need, Don, is a little clarity here. There's a great amount of details, but we really, a lot of people don't understand what the policy is. But if you're trying to identify or define the policy, you cannot do it with all these little details that will point left, right, up, down, and everywhere. And one of the things that I was signing in Paris was that the philosophy was great. The policy was great, but it all hinged on money. Money was being transferred through the UN. And what is that? We have to understand that we are responsible for everything that God created. Well, we must be able to figure out where nature fits in this. Nature is a builder, creates things, but nature also destroys. We have many landslides, lightning, waves come in, kill people, rivers overrun. We have nature doing positive and negative work. But since we don't understand, and what we discussed in this program today was that there's wisdom involved here. We don't know the wisdom of Hashem, but we are believers and we have faith. So therefore, we must work with it or around it, but not ignore it. So therefore, if we're going to do something, we have to be all of the, not the same mind, but at least we know where we're pointed to and the goals are. Because we have to build this. We don't realize that through our existence on the planet, we are guilty of accumulation of a bunch of junk. And for some reason or another, people don't realize they're doing this. But to throw money at it is not a solution. We need thinking and good human thinking to resolve this so that we can change the course of our accumulation to the planet. So we must keep in mind what God's wisdom is there, and it's working. Mother Nature, or nature is working. But the humans also have a place. We have to participate, and we don't need politicians to do it and say, well, that's okay. The problem is solved because we gave the money. Ouch. The problem is only solved when everybody does their own little part and tries to make it a better world. Because together, we can succeed.
Well, I thank you. I will disagree slightly. I was quoting from here and there. I do think that there is a need to think tank into these issues, and there are definitely sources in Torah which can allow people to start to think tank into these matters, to start discussions which otherwise wouldn't take place. Because if I were to boil down my presentation I don't know if I was so successful in the presentation that I gave, but again, it's hopefully to cause people to be aroused to think a little bit deeper into these matters. From the perspective of Torah law, nature is not to be considered holy, but then again, we're not permitted to act ruthlessly towards it, needlessly to ravage it, and to disturb its integrity. So the teaching of Torah as it relates to nature, or working with the delicate ecology of this planet, is that not to glorify nature as something unto itself, but rather that we cannot destroy its intrinsic integrity, which the integrity of nature or this world was, again, coming ultimately from a wisdom of Creator that from a level we don't understand, but we can start, people can start to learn more about it. It can be as simple as take a walk if you live in proximity to a woods, if you live in proximity to a lake, or the ocean. See just the tremendous wisdom that's involved in what makes a forest, a naturally occurring forest, an ocean, a lakeside, and see that with one swoop how this balance can be knocked out. Yes, you could say on one level for a higher good for human beings, but if it creates an imbalance, which I'm just going to ask people to look deeper into what is the implication of imbalance, with as much as there may be a short-term gain, the long-term loss can be immeasurably and beyond rectification until there are prophecies that talk about the rectification of the earth itself, not just rectification of human beings. But with that being said, Dennis, we're going to end today's program. And we didn't get everything we wanted to talk about in, but hopefully we'll reunite next week. And I want to thank, we had one live listener calling in from Virginia. I apologize to you, sir or ma'am, that we didn't connect. Hopefully next week, if you call in, we'll try to bring you in and make the program a little more organic. Dennis, before we sign off, I'm going to make a little pitch for the Hilo LX Life Technology. Any final comments before we sign off?
Yeah, what happens is we have some people who live in the woods. We have some people that live in the concrete canyons of cities. Can we get them together to understand that the wisdom of God is behind us and we can pick out a good future?
Amen. That being said, blessed souls, part of our efforts here is while we're going a little commercial, and I'm not ashamed to do that because we want to try to increase our broadcasting abilities. There is a way to broadcast on a much greater scale to get much greater advertising. And it was brought to my attention by the first week of April by physician's assistant Marlena Christofferson, who lives out in L.A., about a type of life sense technology called Hilo LX. And rather than me go on and on describe what it is all about, I'd like to bring to your attention that there are some links that you can learn more about this LifeSense technology, where you can go to www.hilo.life, and there you can scroll down and you can see a two-minute video called Love at First Beat, explaining simply what is the Hilo LX about. And then if your interest is further perked, you can go to see a video, which is also on the same website, called Our Story, a five-minute presentation, which also includes your ability to join this international organization and become a distributor yourself. As well, there's another link I want to connect you to at www.catalyst777.hilo.life/CP8. And as well, I want to call to your attention, there are various webinars you can access at www.hilo.money, M-O-N-E-Y. We can learn about the product and also how you, as a distributor, with God's blessing, and it will be hard work with no guarantee of what type of income you can generate, you can bring yourself with God's blessings into the opportunity to generate an exponential type of income. But again, it will take hard work with God's blessings. And I can make no guarantee, neither can World Global Network make any guarantees about this. With that being said, before I mention my website store, I just want to make a caveat that anything presented on today's program, Soul Class 653, Torah Free Fall, for those who heeded the call, part one, should not be construed as being with the viewpoint of the World Global Network Corporation. These are my views as a Torah activist, and any views as well espoused by Dennis Ryan were his. And we just want you to know that. And with that, without going any further, I want to cordially invite you to visit my website store at dzg.worldgn.com to purchase your own wellness device. And you too, with God's blessings, can begin a journey of strengthening your self-awareness of your vital life signs. And we want to conclude by mentioning that, as we have done in the past, now that I'm way past the year of being a mourner after the passing of my father, Shlomo Yaakov Ben Kona David. You know, go back to our normal programming and bring to your listening ears, for your listening edification, the wonderful music of our good brother out in jolly old England, David Dome. Help us get back home, to help us realize and internalize our Tzelem Elohim. Our divine image is no dream, and we've got to go out and scrimmage. And we've got to be good. The reason why we've got to be good, blessed souls, is because the Teva Tov Lehetiv, the nature of the good to do good, the Creator who is the source of our goodness, is waiting patiently with mercy and love upon us, and grace as well, that we go and make it a better day and make this world more sustainable. So today's programs will be ending with Good to Talk by David Dome, and may our future talks, maybe good people will be talking good about our efforts. In a way of a Havachad, one love, Goral Achad, one destiny, Kulana for all those, Badarkinom, Darki Shalom, in a pleasant, peaceful way. Take care, everyone, and have a wonderful, blessed week.